This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. A year ago, we asked Hotelier Harris Rosen to outline his vision for a new public school in Paramore. Rosen's foundation will help pay for the preschool education of students at the school. He hopes the school will foster the same kind of success as his program in the Tangelo Park neighbourhood, where more than 450 scholarships have been handed out. We return to the site of the school to check in with Rosen on the progress of the campus, which is scheduled to open in August next year. We're standing on West Livingston Street. There's construction teams, there's kind of diggers and people working away in the background here. Is it good to see the campus kind of taking shape?
Yes, it's very nice to see. And I was not in town when they were pouring the last footing. And we have a rather strange tradition at our little company, where when we build something, when we are pouring the last footing, we throw 9 pennies in. The symbolism is that I was born with a lot of nines. 9, 9, 3, 9. And so the 9 pennies are just for good luck. And so far it's worked really beautifully in all of the things that we've built. And so we did it here, but my son threw the 9 coins in. And he had a good time doing that. And so it's wonderful. I know what I'm about to say is rather presumptuous, but I do believe in my heart of hearts that what we've done in Tangelo Park and what we're doing here, and when I say we, I mean all of the people involved, and because there's so many involved, has the potential of changing America, one community at a time. I've used that phrase before, and I kind of reinforce it because I do believe that. This school, PS8, preschool through 8th grade, might not exist anyplace else in America, maybe in the world, but starting children in school when they're 2 years old is so incredibly critical. Preschool experts will tell you, as they have me, that the advantage that these youngsters have will stay with them forever, the early education advantage. And so here we have done something unusual. We've combined the preschool with kindergarten, elementary school, and middle school, and then all of these youngsters will go on to high school, Jones High School, graduate, go to trade school, community college, or public college here in Florida. When others see how successful this program is, they will come here by the droves, and they will replicate this school all over. And what does it do, aside from infusing hope in neighborhoods like this? Of course, hope is so important. But it helps stabilize inequality. And we have inequality all over the world. But if you're an entrepreneurial society, it's going to exist. Some people are blessed with creativity. Some people are blessed growing up in an affluent neighborhood with a home that has a multitude of advantages. Some people are blessed that they work a little bit harder. That's okay, and one can expect that kind of inequality. But when someone wants to go to college and they can't afford to, that's unfair. So we level the playing field from an educational perspective, and that impacts in a very positive way a multitude of other things. Boy, I know you asked one little question, and I'm babbling here away like crazy, but it's something I'm so passionate about. I've seen the results, and it is sad, frustrating, that others haven't raised their hand and said, Harris, we're going to do this in Detroit. We're going to do it in Chicago. I don't understand it. I don't expect the public sector to do this. Almost $20 trillion in the hole. You guys got enough on your plate. But the private sector can step forward and say, we love America, we love education, we'll adopt a neighborhood near our headquarters or near our arena or near our stadium or near where our foundation offices are. But Matthew, I don't understand. I'm not disparaging our private sector, because I suspect America, the private sector, is probably more philanthropic than all of the other nations combined, times probably 10. But we have problems here in America. Look at what's going on.
You've got a pretty strong vision of what this is going to be. Like, you, sounds like you can see all the way through, you know, 15, 20 years into the future, even though the foundations are still wet, you know, the concrete's not yet dry.
I can. But understand that we have 24 years of experience at Tangible Park, and so that helps. But no, I can close my eyes. And we've already given out about 15 college scholarships to the youngsters graduating who live in the neighborhood and graduated from Jones. And so I can kind of, in my mind, extrapolate that to hundreds of youngsters in college and a school that's thriving and a school that has become the model for this concept, and people coming and you interviewing them and saying, how did you hear about this? And what are you planning on doing? And where are you planning on doing it? I know it sounds silly, but we need something like this in America. We need to level that playing field. And this is one way of doing it. Are there other ways? Of course there are. Will people come forward with ideas that help? Absolutely. This is not the only answer, but it is an answer. And it's a bit frustrating that in 24 years, and good results, no one has stepped forward to say, we'll create a similar program.
Is this preschool through eighth grade school, is it a bit of an experiment in some ways?
It is, yeah, it is, Matthew. It is an experiment. Now, there are examples of kindergarten through eighth grade, but for some reason, there has been a disinclination to include the 2 and 3 and some 4-year-olds. I don't know why exactly, because that preschool component is absolutely critical. Now, there are nursery schools that do that. There are daycare facilities that do that. So there are people who are sending their youngsters to school when they're 2 years old. But to combine it in one facility, I don't think has ever been done before. And our responsibility is that preschool component to make sure that it operates well, that the caregivers, teachers do their job well, that they have everything they need to make sure that the youngsters are getting the best education possible. The ratio is 6 to 1, 6 students, 1 teacher, because it works so well at Tangelo. Orange County Public Schools, 18 or 20 to 1. I guess it's a money issue, which is really quite sad, because our youngsters deserve the very best. So this is an experiment, as you suggest. And my hope and my prayer is that it will be a resounding success, so that others will say, you know, the next school we build, let's tack on a program for the 2 and 3-year-olds, and let's find a foundation, a company, an individual who will provide all expense paid scholarships to the youngsters from the neighborhood who are graduating from high school and going on to college. In the Army, one of the first things I remember in basic training, a very large sergeant major, and we were a bunch of budding lieutenants, wrote on the blackboard KISS, and we said, oh my God, where's this guy going? We didn't have any idea. And he said, you'll never forget this as long as you live. Keep it simple, stupid. Yes, our program is so simple. It's not complicated at all. Find someone to write checks and start at 2 years old and make sure that when the youngsters graduate from high school, they have opportunities to go on to college, community college, or trade school.
This new campus we're standing opposite of, it's not the only new thing that's springing up in Parramore. We've got a new soccer stadium being built too. How big of a role do you think the school is going to play in just raising the standard of living in Parramore?
Well, I think it's going to have a very positive impact. So at Tangelo Park, a significant concern was, no longer is, a concern that many people have in underserved communities. It's called mobility or turnover. Tangelo was turning over about 80%. People were losing their jobs, and wherever they were able to find a job, they would take the family, pack up, and leave. Now, mobility in Tangelo is a minuscule fraction of that. Why? Home values are going up, so the longer you stay there, the more your home is worth. Also, why would you leave a neighborhood where your 2- and 3-year-old can go to school without any expense to you, and where your children are guaranteed a free college education, so they stay there? The same thing will happen here. Parramore is rather mobile. It turns over a lot. This is going to reduce that dramatically. I think also what happened in Tangelo, which was a huge surprise, crime in the neighborhood down about 65%. I mean, that's really extraordinary. And so I think the feeling that the people who live in the neighborhood have and the feeling that people who visit the neighborhood have is that it's a safe neighborhood. It's a good neighborhood. It's a neighborhood that is prospering. And I think the same is going to happen here. A lot of it is psychological, but I think people will now talk about Parramore much differently than they have in recent years.
Is there a risk, though, that folks have been here for a long time might be priced out or forced out of their own neighborhood?
That's a great question. And we've expressed that concern, and so there are statutes in place that prevent exorbitant escalations in rent, that kind of rent control, which other cities have done quite successfully, just to prevent what you're suggesting. Now, this is not a scholarship program for middle-income or wealthy individuals. And so a concern that I had was exactly what you just expressed, that things would change so dramatically that we would be in a position of providing scholarships to youngsters who really didn't need our help. I don't think that's going to happen, certainly not in the foreseeable future. Now, what will happen naturally is that as the neighborhood develops, as the neighborhood prospers, income levels will improve, and that's fine. That's sort of a natural anticipation that we have, that the neighborhood will begin to change, as Tangelo has. Home values in Tangelo have gone from about $45,000 to $200,000 over the last 24 years. That's a good thing. So I suspect the same thing will happen here. So I just want this to be successful, and I want others who are experiencing challenges in their neighborhoods, wherever it may be, to come here and witness what has occurred here and think about replicating it.
You want some folks who've got some money in their pocket and wondering what to do with it to come and see what's going on and where they can help.
Yeah, I would really like that. People who have money in their pocket and don't know what to do with it. I can give them some ideas.
What about the folks who have graduated from the programs in Tangelo Park or Jones High School? Do you keep in touch with them?
We do a banquet every year, and we have 100, 150 youngsters coming from all over. And we ask them to do just one thing. We have a beautiful banquet, and it's very emotional. And the one thing we ask them to do is give us a 2- or 3-minute or 5-minute report on what they're doing, where they are, and whatever else they want to say. A lot of tears, because it's so wonderful to hear the great success stories. I was the first one in my family to even think about going to college, and now I'm going to grad school. Or I was the first one in my family to go to college, and now I have a job that I've dreamt about having all my life. I mean, the most wonderful stories, and we just sit there, I do, sit there and just say thank you, God. It's just so wonderful to know that good things have happened and to hear it firsthand.
Harris Rosen, you've obviously got a pretty long-term commitment to Tangelo Park and now to Paramore, but is there any other neighborhood you can think of that you would like to get into? And
you're just going to get me into trouble, Matthew. Listen, sadly, tragically, there are so many underserved communities. And my financial guys tell me to calm down because we do have a business. We are involved with so many other projects. And I do have a tendency, I think, to get a little bit ahead of things. So my guys have said, for the time being, just take a deep breath, and there'll be other people that'll come along.
Harris Rosen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Matthew. Appreciate it.
Still to come on Intersection, kids are back in school, and Orange County has a lot of them. How Orange County schools are facing a year of growth, standardized testing, and staying safe. We'll talk with Superintendent Barbara Jenkins about the challenges of educating Orange County's growing population and what she's looking forward to this school year. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. Orange County School Superintendent Barbara Jenkins heads up the fourth largest school district in the state. We talked to Jenkins about the debate over standardized testing and the challenge of ensuring there are enough classrooms for a growing population. She began the conversation by outlining the school district's approach to security.
So I want to mention two things. One, a few years ago, after there was a horrific crime that was nationally reported, we had experts to come in and look at our safety and security efforts and to give us advisement. And so we have followed fairly closely what those experts told us should be in place. And so we have several measures, most of which we don't publicize because that's part of our security is that we don't make them public. But we've got several efforts underway and several that have already been completed around securing our schools so that they are not easily accessible. Concerning resource officers, we have, in most cases, in high schools, more than one officer. Middle schools have one officer. And then elementary schools have intermittent or rotating coverage by those resource officers. All of our data and all of our recommendations support that model, but we believe we have the processes in place to make sure we do everything possible to keep our students safe. And again, we don't even talk about the intermittent visiting of our elementary schools. Nobody knows when, what time and what days officers are going to be in those elementary schools. And then our local law enforcement are extremely supportive. They patrol and make sure they keep an eye on our schools as well.
When you say local law enforcement, are you referring to, say, Orlando Police or Orange County Sheriffs or the law enforcement agency that I understand is now operating within Orange County Public Schools?
So I want to be very clear. That's a good question, Matthew. Actually, our sworn officers for Orange County Public Schools is a very small force. They serve as a coordinating role, one in each of our five learning communities, to help make sure they're coordinating with local law enforcement. Our school resource officers are still from our local entities, and so the Sheriff's Department, OPD, Winter Park, Apopka, and the other small cities, they provide our local resource officers. And then our very small group of sworn officers help to coordinate and do some preventative measures in those schools as well. So in our schools, we've got SROs, school resource officers, that are usually from the local entity, and then those patrol cars that are available certainly keep an eye on our schools, even if they're not school resource officers. We've got tremendous support from law enforcement.
How's that Orange County Public School law enforcement liaison working out? Because that's fairly new, isn't it?
It is. We actually started it in the last couple of years. Again, that was part of the recommendation that came from our security consultants, other large districts throughout the state, have a very large sworn police force that actually is a part of the school system. And so we decided not to invest largely in a significant force, but rather a hybrid model where we still depend on our local law enforcement and we have a small sworn force that helps to coordinate and provide some preventative measures as well. But Miami-Dade, Broward County, others have very large forces.
Does your school district have any plans to increase the number of those officers?
No, our plan is really a hybrid model where we still depend on local law enforcement for school resource officers. Our force would top out at probably about 16, actually in each of our learning communities having a lead and two support officers. Five learning communities, that comes to 15 plus an overall director of the program.
One of the concerns you hear about that is people are worried that it might lead to, for example, more arrests. Is that something you had to think through before putting this force in place?
Absolutely. And so our strategies really are around making sure we decrease arrests. We want to see more civil citations. Again, that's in partnership with our local law enforcement. Having sworn officers as a part of the school system, as you might note from information from other districts, actually should decrease the arrests. But we're working very closely again. We want to see civil citations and limited arrests of our young people.
I want to ask you, too, about a loophole that was reported on back in May, I believe, of former employees could have gotten access to school buildings. Has that loophole now been closed?
It has been closed. It was a matter of technology where you have badges and you are able to swipe your way in and out. I will tell you, for the most part, although those were some retired or former employees, they were not accessing, trying to get into our schools. They just needed to be deleted from the system so they wouldn't have possible access. It's also important to note, when employees leave us, we normally take those badges anyway. But deleting them from the system was critical.
Barbara Jenkins, let's talk a little bit about the construction underway in Orange County schools, because you have a big district, as you point out, and there is a pretty big construction project underway at the moment, as I understand, some $600 million, 22 schools, and a few opening this year, some opening next year. Do you get the sense that the planning you have, the construction underway, is enough to keep up with demand? Because Orlando, Central Florida, the population is growing at a pretty steady rate.
That's absolutely true, Matthew. And I will tell you, this year we're projected to have 5,000 new students compared to last year. Puts us over 200,000 students here in Orange County Public Schools. And so, thanks to our voters, that halfpenny sales tax helps us to both renovate existing schools and to build some additional schools. This year, three brand new schools opening to help accommodate the growth, four schools opening that are newly renovated as well. And as you mentioned, next year, some 17 or more projects will be completed for the following year. I think if the growth continues at the pace that it is currently moving, that we may have challenges in years to come to keep up with it purely by the halfpenny sales tax and impact fees. But that remains to be seen. Currently, we have a plan that should accommodate our projected growth. What's amazing is while other districts experienced declining enrollment or flatlining enrollment even during the recession, Orange County continued to grow.
Some students have to get rezoned due to closures, other changes in downtown Orlando schools. We've got Cayley, Lake Como, Fern Creek. Now, when those changes were announced, some folks weren't happy, but in the end, were they fairly satisfied with where their students would be going, where their kids would be going?
We think we have, in general, pretty good satisfaction. The Lake Como Cayley example that you mentioned, they'll be combined for a short period, and then they're going to have a brand new K-8 school, and so that's a really wonderful reward for those communities. If you recall, bringing those students who had been bused for years to eight or more different schools to a central location in the downtown Paramore area meant that some of those other schools became extremely small. You just can't financially afford to keep them open. And so some of those combinations, while it may have been painful at first, we've had pretty good follow-up response from those communities.
Let me just come back to new construction. Now, sometimes residents aren't happy to have a new school in their neighborhood. If you look at what was happening out in West Orange, for example, are you expecting there'll be more opposition to whatever new schools are in the works?
The middle school in the Avalon area and the West Orange relief sites were quite controversial with community members, because the truth is sometimes neighbors think that a school may not make the best neighbor for their community. And so we worked through that with the county, and we believe we had a good resolution with our neighbors as well. The truth is, we're very good neighbors. Wedgefield as well, I think that community is overjoyed now that the construction is complete and that school is in place. Our schools are really community assets, but when you're going through the initial acquisition of property and the actual construction, sometimes people are a little uncomfortable. Coming up, and Matthew, this might be helpful for folks to know, usually we have purchased property years in advance of when we need them. Coming up for future projects, we're going to make absolutely certain that neighbors are aware that the property is being acquired and that we have every question around zoning dealt with prior to the official or final purchase of the property. We've done that in the past, but some have at least critiqued that we could have been more thorough or more transparent for the community members at least. But in the end, I think neighbors have to agree we're pretty good neighbors.
Is there any land you're looking to buy this year, this school year?
So we're always looking at land. I don't see anything that's controversial coming up. I will tell you, when we look at high school properties, for example, we're usually looking at areas that don't have significant neighboring communities to deal with, because high schools are significant. Elementary and middle schools, usually those are, with developers, are usually plotted out and set aside very early on while they're developing their neighborhoods and communities. And so we don't see anything extremely controversial coming up. I should knock on wood. But we feel pretty confident in those projects that we have coming forward.
How do you make that pitch, though? I mean, you say that you're good neighbors and that once the construction's done, people are pretty happy with it, but you have sometimes residents complaining about noise, traffic, lights, if there's, you know, after school sports going on. How do you make that pitch to residents who are seem pretty entrenched and not wanting a school near their neighborhood?
So in most instances, if we have enough parents that are in that general vicinity or in that community, they have to speak up and say, here is why we want a school, a local school here to serve our children. What Orange County is supposed to do, required to do, is place schools where the children are so that they can be served. Wouldn't make sense to place schools remotely and then just bus students out of communities to some remote location. And so parents in general have to speak up and support our efforts as well, because they want those schools in their local neighborhoods. I think we also have to make a case in some instances where there are assertions that we are disruptive to a very quiet neighborhood. Sometimes we have to come back and say there have been other development projects going on or other institutions put in those same neighborhoods that were treated quite friendly by neighbors, and the neighborhood already was not so quiet and remote as perhaps they had once hoped when they moved there. But I think the biggest argument we make is schools need to be located where the children are, and communities have families and children and parents that quite often have to speak up and say, this is what we want for our community because it's serving our children.
Let's move on to testing, Barbara Jenkins. I wonder if you could just tell me a little bit about the results of a recent survey that asked parents and teachers about testing, teacher evaluations, school grades, that kind of thing.
So the state of Florida put out an open survey to receive stakeholder input. It was around the new federal guidelines for the Every Student Succeeds Act, federal legislation. And part of the requirement for your Title I and Title II and Title III, part of the requirement is that you get community input, stakeholder input. And so the state did open up a portal to say, give us your feedback on these issues. Suffice it to say that the new law is voluminous. It's certainly intimidating to anyone who goes on a website and tries to thrash through all of that detail. And so what we did here locally for our parents was to break it down into some small digestible pieces and to say, give us your thoughts, your feedback on these particular areas. And then we asked for our parents or any other stakeholders to give us feedback. Over 500 responded. That's certainly a small sample since we serve 200,000 students, but a sample of about 500 responded and gave us their feedback. And then we encouraged them both to go on the state website, and then we consolidated their responses and submitted that to the state as well.
Is there some impetus for change as far as those parents are concerned?
Our parents had some concerns and some ideas that we passed on. The State Department of Education and the State Board of Education would have to actually be a part of any significant changes. I will tell you, one of the issues that has been brought up repeatedly is whether or not the A through F grading system for our schools hasn't served its time, that it's time to look at something different for Florida. And so we will certainly raise that issue on behalf of our schools and community, but whether or not it changes is a legislative matter in Florida. What the new ESSA requires is that you at least have three categories for labeling your school, some kind of comprehensive label. There is no requirement for A through F. We believe in many instances, labeling a school with lower grades such as D and F really serve, it's counterintuitive, it really drives both the student talent and the adult talent away from the school when those are our schools where we need more talent and we need students who are high performing and teachers who are doing a fantastic job to stay in those schools. So it's been detrimental when intended to somehow put pressure on schools for improvement. It's really been detrimental and helped to empty out talent in some of those schools. And so probably that, if I had to pick one area that we'd love to see changed in the accountability system, it's the A through F grading, but that's not our call solely. It would actually have to be a legislative matter.
What about this idea of replacing the Florida Standards Assessment with a national test like the SAT or the ACT? Is that something you would like to see changed?
So we saw very positive feedback from our parents on that, the notion that you could use what they perceived to be an extremely reliable test measure for students was attractive to I believe a majority of our parents. There are some problems in Florida under our current accountability system because we use testing outcomes both for teacher evaluations, a VAM model, as well as a graduation requirement in our high schools. And so several states who have switched over to using a nationally standardized test such as SAT don't have those two purposes behind their accountability system, using those scores for teacher evaluation, individual teacher evaluation, and for a graduation requirement. So there's some technicalities, some glitches that would have to be worked through, but I certainly think it's a viable option that should be further considered because our parents also thought that they would prefer it.
One of the things we hear a lot about when it comes to testing is folks who just want to opt out of test, you know, the opt-out movement. Is that a group of people who you feel like you've got some dialogue with, or are you expecting some more challenges coming up this school year?
We have a small contingency that comes to speak with the board on a fairly regular basis. I will tell you what the law did that previously was not a deterrent made it a little bit more difficult for parents to opt out, especially for third grade promotion requirements. We suspect that the state will have some softening of some of those requirements because of the outcry that they experienced around third grade retention. We certainly don't want to see third graders retained purely because of a failure to take a test. Having a portfolio assessment in place or some other measures for those students is critical. My guess is that there'll be some continued conversation at the legislative level this year regarding that. So for our parents, I will tell you we've tried to work closely. We feel like we've worked through almost every issue where parents had concerns about their students participating, but those numbers were fairly small.
We're just months away from the presidential election, Barbara Jenkins. A new administration could bring in a new direction for education at a national level. Is that something that keeps you up at night?
You know, we've had some opportunities at the national level to have a few conversations. Had an opportunity, a national organization, Council of Great City Schools, we actually met with the president on a couple of occasions, and then we've had conversation with the U.S. Department of Education as well. Here's what I would probably predict. If there is Democratic leadership elected in November, then the Every Student Succeeds Act will need to be administered, and there'll be some minor changes. Some could be significant changes, certainly. I think if there is Republican leadership elected, there may be substantial changes. And some would even go as far as to predict that there may not even be a need in the eyes of some for a Department of Education at the federal level, which I don't, I can't tell you. It's hard to predict what kind of impact that would have. We certainly need administration of federal programs such as Title I to make sure students in poverty are given some additional resources. But to have no U.S. Department of Education would leave a lot of those decisions, I assume, to the state level, where it would have to be managed as well. So either way, there'll be changes. I would just predict there'd be more significant changes with Republican leadership if, as some have predicted, they would do away with the Department of Education at the federal level and just give those resources to the state.
So what are you most looking forward to looking at this school year ahead, Barbara Jenkins?
I love the first day of school. I've always enjoyed the first day of school, both when I was a student, when I was a teacher, principal, central office. First day of school is so exciting for our young people and for our teachers. And so I look forward, although summer seems to have gone by pretty swiftly, I look forward to engaging and going and visiting schools and classrooms to see our young people. They are simply brilliant. And so that's what I love most about my job, is actually going to schools and visiting and seeing what our young people are so capable of. I look forward to that more than anything for a new school year.
Barbara Jenkins is the superintendent of Orange County Public Schools. Thank you so much.
Pleasure, Matthew.
Still to come on Intersection, summer vacation may be over for students and teachers, but Universal has just rolled out new rides. We check out the new Hulk and Kong rides, plus what Disney and SeaWorld are doing to lure you into their parks. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. There's a new King Kong movie opening next year, but if you're a fan of the iconic character, you don't have to wait. Universal's Islands of Adventure opened a new ride, Skull Island Reign of Kong. Universal's not the only theme park trying to entice visitors with new attractions. Well, joining me now is John Busdecker. He's journalist and entertainment reporter at Wish and Orlando My Way. Welcome to Intersection.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with this new ride at Universal, Skull Island Reign of Kong. Here's Mike West, executive producer at Universal Creative.
Kong has been a major part of our family for a long time, so it's kind of bringing him home. We had surveys in the years past where guests said, you know, do you want to see Kong come back? And it's always been, yes, absolutely. So we had him out in Universal Studios in Hollywood with the Kong 360 3D, and that was such a big hit. Kind of took the idea of that, but then expanded it out into the full Skull Island experience.
So, John, tell me about this ride. What is it? Is it a facelift for an old roller coaster? Is it brand new?
Yeah, it's what they call a dark ride. As Mike, that's Mike West, he mentioned that Kong used to be at Universal Orlando. Kongfrontation, when Universal Orlando opened back in the early 90s, it was one of their premier rides. And it was Kong, and you got to get in this sort of car, and you'd kind of go through the streets of New York. And that ran for several years, and I believe it closed down in the early 2000s. And so now they have Reign of Kong, Skull Island Reign of Kong. And like I said, it's what they call a dark ride. And so you get in this vehicle. The vehicle moves all over. It's a huge ride vehicle, too. This is one of the brand new things with this ride. It holds something like 72 people. You get on. You go through the huge gates. And you're not really sure what's going to happen. And then all these sort of 3D screens are all over, and you sort of see what happens when Kong and these prehistoric creatures start fighting each other. And there's sort of a mix of animation with these computer screens, but also some figures at the end of the ride as well.
So it's not like a high-speed thing?
No. If you get sick on roller coasters, this might be a good ride for you, because it's inside most of it, and you're mostly in this big ride vehicle. Mm-hmm. There's some parts where, you know, you put your 3D glasses on and things sort of come at you, and there's some extra things as well with when some of the animals or some of the creatures get killed, I guess you might get a little wet on the ride too.
So are you a roller coaster guy? I mean, what makes a good ride for you?
I like roller coasters, I'll be honest with you. I like them a lot, but I can't ride them all day long, which is sort of a thing with me, because this is what I cover. I can't be on them for, you know, 10 hours straight. There's some people that can just ride rides all day long. I can ride them for a little while. I have to take a little bit of a break, but I guess every ride's different. I mean, we were talking about Universal Orlando. You know, they just reopened Incredible Hulk Coaster, and that's been a whole year in the making. They basically just renovated the thing. They didn't change the ride layout. They just changed the track. They changed the ride vehicle. They changed the queue. They changed the storyline. But the actual ride's pretty much the same. And so for that ride, you know, it has its little sort of quirks with it. When you first get on it, you go up this hill, and you sit there for half a second, then all of a sudden it just shoots you out of the tunnel there. It goes from 0 to 40 in 2 seconds. And then you have rides like Mako over at SeaWorld, their newest ride, and that's what they call more of a hyper coaster. There's no sort of inversions. There's no upside down loop-de-loops. It's just hills the entire time. And so during that ride, you do feel sort of that, what they call weightlessness when you're on a roller coaster. You feel it sort of in your stomach as you go up and down all the different hills there. And that ride's long. I mean, it's like a 3-minute ride. It's one of the longest, it's the longest, fastest, and tallest roller coaster in Central Florida.
There's a movie that debuts next year too, Kong Skull Island. Isn't it usually the other way around? We get the movie, then the ride comes after that?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure sort of how the two mix. They have talked about it a little bit. I believe some of the action on Skull Island actually takes place before the movie that came out in 2005. Somebody might tweet in right now and correct me on that. But yeah, right now, I mean, that Universal, you know, they own sort of the rights to Kong, and this is sort of the thing they've said a lot. Kong is part of the Universal story. I mean, Kong dates back to the 1930s,
right?
And that's been sort of their property for that long. And so just having a ride with Kong is sort of an important step for Universal Orlando.
So the movie is kind of a separate piece in some ways.
Yeah.
It's pretty competitive in the theme park business. Mike West at Universal last week was downplaying the idea of an arms race or a war between the parks. So let's just listen to a little bit of that.
I don't know if it's ever been a war. I think competition is always healthy, you know, and no matter where you are. And I think it the guests benefit because we're constantly pushing each other to create something newer, bigger, better. And I think the end result is that there's just great guest experiences. And I know from our standpoint, we've opened over 20 new guest experiences in the last, 4 years, I think, and with a lot more coming down the road. So it's just going to keep getting bigger and better.
John, you were mentioning Universal's Hulk ride, and you talked about SeaWorld's new coaster as well. There's a bunch of other things happening as well, but do you get the sense that the pace of new rides, new experiences kind of picking up in these big theme parks in Central Florida?
This summer especially, they're all sort of ramping up things to do at each of their parks. As we mentioned, SeaWorld, they have Mako, which was their big sort of roller coaster this year. Universal Orlando, Skull Island Reign of Kong, Incredible Hulk Coaster. They also have a new dessert restaurant and cafe that's going to open that's sort of based on, it's not based on Willy Wonka, but it's going to be like a sort of steampunk inspired restaurant that's opening up later this year. But Disney's opened a lot of things this year. They have a new Frozen ride. They have this Tree of Life, which is at Animal Kingdom. They have a new princess. I just went to that the other day. Princess Elena of Avalor, the first Latin-inspired princess. And all of their parks, I mean, they've had something this year called Awakened Summer, which is sort of rolling out the I called it the Aladdin carpet for all these new things. But, I mean, Mike West is right. I mean, everybody is trying to grab people's tourism dollars, really, especially people on vacation and people who live here locally. And to do that, you sort of have to sort of step up your game, because if you've been to Universal 1 year, and the next year everything's sort of the same, you're going to say, well, maybe I should go to Disney this time, and vice versa. And so they constantly have to update. And also with Disney, we didn't even talk about this, is Disney Springs.
Right.
Disney Springs has basically exploded this year because of all the new shops and restaurants and just attractions that are opening out there. And that's the whole idea of keeping people on Disney property as long as they can. So if you're staying out there, you know, I don't want to make that trek all the way down to downtown Orlando. I'm just going to stay at Disney Springs and do all this great stuff.
So it sounds like there's still a bit of life left in the princess themed attractions too.
I think there's always life in princess. I don't have any children, but you know, if you have, you know, a little girl, you know, of course she wants to grow up and to be a princess when she's 4 or 5 years old. Mm-hmm. Every time I go out there, you know, there's you know, people dressed in little girls dressed in dresses. I mean that's the reason people go to Disney, and that's sort of the difference between the two. I mean, when you're younger, a lot of people, that's where they go to Disney. They take their kids to Disney. But when you get to be, you know, 13, 14, 15, at least for me when I was that age, you know, you might not want to go to Disney then. You might want to go over to Universal or even SeaWorld to ride I guess, big boy rides.
Mm-hmm. And then I guess we're looking at Halloween coming up in a couple months, and that's quite popular.
Halloween's a big one. At Disney, we have Mickey's Not-So-Scary Halloween, which does well every year. But Universal is really bringing it this year as well with Halloween Horror Nights 26. I've been covering this since they've been releasing all these different houses. I mean, there's a house on The Exorcist. There's a house on Halloween. There's a just all kinds of different houses. But their big thing, which they announced last week, is this new virtual reality experience, they're calling it. It's actually an extra $50 to do. Mm-hmm. And they didn't release a ton of details about it. But basically, you put on a virtual reality helmet and I think the quote was, your most personal and intimate fears will be addressed or something like that.
Right.
And it's a mix of both virtual reality and real life experiences. So we don't really know exactly what it's going to be, but it should be pretty interesting.
So there's still a place for those scare actors, right?
I mean,
that's
kind
of a big deal in Florida.
Yeah. I mean, that's a job to have. I mean, I've covered that in the past where, you know, you get to see sort of how they get made up and they get a lot of people that come back year after year to be scare actors. And it's not even just Universal, I should say. There's a whole lot of Halloween stuff coming up. Spooky Empire, which is a big convention, horror movie convention, that's moved from a hotel where it's been at for several years over to a convention center because it's just getting bigger and bigger every year.
Mm-hmm. How did smaller attractions compete with these big players?
I think they know their market. They know their niche market. So Fun Spot, you know if you go to Fun Spot, it doesn't cost anything to get into Fun Spot, so you're saving money there. It doesn't cost any money to park at Fun Spot, so you know you've saved some costs there. And especially if you have maybe a family that, you know, not everybody's going to be riding rides and not everybody's going to be going on all this stuff, but maybe just your younger kids are. And so, okay, we pay for the roller coaster, we pay for the go-karts, and it might be a little less expensive than paying for the entire family to go to Disney for the day. Mm-hmm. It's the same as Gatorland. I mean, I was out at Gatorland the other day and they talk about that. A lot of times those destinations, those smaller attractions will say, we want those people to come to our place maybe after they've gone to Disney or Universal. You know, they spent their money there, they spent their time there for 2-3 days, and now you can come to us and spend a little less money and maybe not spend, you're not going to spend 5 days at Gatorland. You're going to spend maybe 3-4 hours and also get to see something a little more sort of old Florida in an old Florida attraction.
Mm-hmm. This is providing they can pry them away from Disney Springs or
it's
some of those
true.
Other places,
yeah,
right?
That's a big challenge. I mean, you do have to get people away from those spots, but and that's where a lot of these discounts come in too. I mean, with Gatorland, I believe they're doing like Florida resident rates, but you know, they always have coupons out there. And once again, if you're from, you know, if you're from England, you're from, you know, somewhere far off, you don't get to see an alligator very often. And so that's sort of their thing. You know, they bring them in, you get to see, I don't know if you've ever been to Gatorland or not, but it's a fun attraction. It's something mm-hmm. that you don't see anywhere else hardly in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have those albino gators, right?
They do. They have three of them, I believe. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and there's more too. I mean, all those attractions on iDrive, you know, the Sleuth Mystery Theater and the Titanic and even this new zombie attraction where you can go in and shoot zombies. I mean, it's just all these things that people are trying to get the tourists who maybe have already spent their time and money at Disney one more chance to maybe get a few dollars from them.
Let's just talk quickly, John Busticker, about what else is on the horizon for the World of Attractions. You mentioned iDrive. Now, there are some other pretty big plans mm-hmm. for iDrive. What do we got going on there in the near future?
Well, I think the main thing that people are really watching for is the Skyplex, the giant 500-foot roller coaster / hotel that's supposed to go up at Sand Lake and International Drive. And, you know, I think we're all waiting to see what's going to happen with that. I know they've had some sort of issues with Universal and Neighbors and all that, but that seems to all be worked out. And so I think we're just waiting to see maybe the ground being broken there, and mm-hmm. hopefully that'll go up.
There's a new water park too, Universal's water park coming in.
Yeah, Volcano Bay is supposed to open next year. They haven't exactly said the exact date yet, but it's sometime early summer. They've started advertising it, but probably the biggest thing to look for there, I should talk about the water park. It's going to be one of the largest water parks in the world. I think it's 17 or 18 different slides, all based around this volcano. There's waterfalls and secret like passages, and it's going to be a third park for Universal. It's not mm-hmm. just going to be a small attraction. I mean, it's going to be a full day's worth of fun over there. And it's all built right next to the other parks at Universal. So once again, you're keeping people sort of on Universal property. But then the real big question is what happens with Wet n Wild? Because Universal owns Wet and Wild. And right. so once and that's supposed to close at the end of the year. So when that closes, Volcano Bay opens. Now Universal has this big piece of property right there at iDrive and Universal Boulevard, I believe. And nobody really knows what's going to happen. Oh, somebody knows, but I don't know what's going to happen there.
Well, John Bostic covers entertainment for Wish and Orlando My Way. Thank you so much for joining us, John.
Thanks for having me.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.